So he mentioned that in certain situations you have an embedded eigenvalue somewhere, and under perturbation it is unstable. In particular, it might either split in two eigenvalues or disappear. And so I'll give a, this is a result, an old result of Green lattice in the context of these operators. I will talk also about eigenvalues which might lie here at the ends of the continuous spectrum, and the same sort of situation there, what happens there. So this can be described as Fermi golden rule. I will use classical tools from the 60s, early 70s, in particular ideas by James Hall, and in particular the result of Green lattice, which is of 1990, can be completely described, understood very well using Hall and plus classical theory of Kato, a famous paper of 1966 of Kato. Okay, so I will just consider operators of this type. Sigma 3, so I have a moment to explain, is just this matrix 1, 0, 0, minus 1. The operators described, which arise in, I'm considering operators of this type. F and G are real valued functions, rapidly decreasing and smooth. H, in particular, H in particular is a non-self adjoint operator. What do we want to say? Let's see. So the spectrum. So H, can be more or less viewed as a pair of Schrödinger operators pointing one in one direction, say in the positive direction, and the other one in the opposite direction. That explains why you have the continuous spectrum formed by two half lines looking like this. But the operator is non-self adjoint, so you might have eigenvalues which lay outside of the real axis, or in particular you can have some which lie on the imaginary axis. These embedded eigenvalues, so one has a little bit to discuss about them. These are sort of a Schrödinger, these maybe are like a Schrödinger-like phenomenon, Schrödinger operator-like phenomenon, in the sense that if you think that operator somewhat as a pair of Schrödinger operators pointing one in one direction and the other one in the other direction, this lambda naught, which is embedded inside here, can be thought as an eigenvalue of the Schrödinger operator, which is pointing this direction. Okay, and I don't know if the it is well known. So that in the context of short-range Schrödinger operators, there are no eigenvalues embedded in the continuous spectrum. So here there are. So here one can cook up very easily using the idea that I just said. Embedded eigenvalues. I don't know if there are other ways, other mechanisms by which one can get embedded eigenvalues in the continuous spectrum. So certainly by taking two Schrödinger operators, one opposite to the other, and just opposing the eigenvalues of one with the continuous spectrum of the other. I don't know if there is some other mechanism. Well, I'll say a few things. So the operator, so here lambdas are the eigenvalues of H, and there is some, I will assume, let's say, a Jordan block. In fact, I will really, well, I will assume a Jordan block decomposition. I will explain, these operators here have finitely many eigenvalues, and the sum of the corresponding eigenspaces is finite. And I will assume, or in certain circumstances, I can prove that there is a H invariant decomposition of the space, where this part can be thought as a beginning of Jordan block decomposition of the operator H. And I will describe in a few minutes the fact that H of C can be thought as the continuous spectrum of the problem. Let's see what I want to say. So H star is the adjoint of H. There is a the corresponding decomposition. This H of C is defined in this way. Now, a decomposition of this type is a textbook fact. If the eigenvalues are isolated, I mean, are not embedded, if you have embedded eigenvalues, the fact that there are, the fact whether or not there are decompositions in, like this of, like in, of L2 of the ambient space, is not obvious to me, at least. An important parameter here in the discussion is the energy. If F, so here F, the functions F, L2 is the space of, of vectors, okay, so of functions with two entries, which, and with the two entries both in L2. So these are not just real-valued functions, but plane-valued functions, if you want. There is a notion of energy, is this one, and the energy can be either positive or negative, and if F belongs to an eigenspace, and this and the corresponding eigenvalue is positive, then the an important element here in the discussion will be the sign of the energy of a point, F. Now, if lambda is a positive eigenvalue and F is a corresponding eigenfunction, the sign of the energy is the sign of this quadratic form here. So, it's the difference of the two norms of the two components taken in the right order. Let's see. So now in my discussion, I mean, as a prerequisite of everything that I discuss later, I need to make a, I mean, this, now we start a peripheral discussion which has somehow has elements which are fundamental for what comes next. Now, so first of all, do you want to understand, so here the behavior of H inside here is pretty trivial. I mean, it's just a matrix. These are just, H acts as a finite dimensional matrix in these eigenspaces. And, but what's the behavior of H inside this space here? And my argument, and the way you study this is very similar to the way you study the behavior of a Schrödinger operator when restricted in the continuous spectrum. One way to understand a Schrödinger operator when restricted in the continuous spectrum is to compare it with the Laplacian, with the behavior of the Laplacian in L2, and there is, in spectral theory, classical spectral theory gives you a way to conjugate the Laplacian into a Schrödinger, short-range Schrödinger operator by means of wave operators, of the so-called wave operators. So there is a way to define an isomorphism from L2 into this space here, which is an isomorphism in L2. In particular, the operator in this direction is called, I will call it W, and so that you know the action of H inside here is the conjugate of the action of this operator here, which is essentially two pairs of the Laplacian inside here. Okay. The wave operator is defined taking the paper of Kato, work of Kato of 1960, is in this way. Evidently, I mean, you have to make sure that somehow this expression here doesn't blow up. I mean, when you look at something like this, you notice that you are, say, if you take, for example, epsilon here to be positive, you are taking a function. You are trying to see if here you have functions which are in Hardy space H2 in this variable, okay? I mean, this formula here, I mean, in order to make sense, I mean, you need this thing not to blow up. I mean, one thing that might make, might destroy what we are writing here, what I'm writing here, is that this could blow up because after all, the resolvent has singularities, okay? A and B are localized. So what I'm doing here now is to split. I'm always free to split V in a product of two matrices, and these two matrices are can be picked always to be localized. So I try to define a wave operator, something, a wave operator is something that will send this to this, and in order to be completely characterized, I need to take only, I mean, I take inner product only with these, which belong in an appropriate subspace. Okay, and the point is exactly as what happens when you do theory of Schrödinger operators, and the point is that in this way, by restricting V in this space, which is the continuous spectrum, if you want, of the adjoint, you are eliminating the singularities coming from the fact that, you know, this H star has eigenvalues, and the resolvent of H star blows up. So we are eliminating these eigenvalues. We are projecting them away. In any case, is this thing well defined? Well, let's see. First of all, we have inequalities like this. So I will not discuss them. This is just the notion of smoothness, Kato's notion of smoothness for, you know, when you have the Laplacians here, H naught is the Laplacian, and A is a rapidly decreasing function. Okay, you look at in Reed and Simon, you will see an explanation of that inequality. So for this expression to make sense, for example, this an inequality like this, number one, will ensure that this formula here makes perfect sense. This is the limit, the value of the limit. There is a limit. I'm going to denote it in this way. And similarly, there is a. If one wants to define the inverse of W, one needs to prove an inequalities like this. So I will just briefly comment on number two, okay, so in order not to work with the adjoint. Okay, so you want to show that. So here you pick the resolvent, you define it. It is defined initially, say, for Z, for the imaginary part of Z larger than zero. You're restricting V is in an appropriate space. So this the resolvent has singularities in correspondence. The resolvent of H has singularities in correspondence of possible eigenvalues lying here. But these singularities, since V is sort of perpendicular to the eigenspace, has zero projection in this in the eigenspaces corresponding to these eigenvalues. These don't harm you. Okay. But if you have eigenvalues, for example, here. Okay, it's not so obvious what happens. Okay, so that's what I'm going to discuss here. Really, what I'm saying, what I'm going to say here is basically a textbook discussion. These are just routine arguments. So one writes, make some sort of factorization like this, and now you're trying to prove that this function on the left hand side is a Hardy function, is in Hardy space in the upper half plane, in the previous slide I said that this factor here, this expression here, is in Hardy space. So the only way in which the whole thing might not be in Hardy space is that this factor here be unbounded somewhere, have singularity. So we look at now the singularities of this expression, and here you have an operator Q naught, which is compact, and so here you can apply analytic Fredholm theory, and there will be singularities in correspondence to zeros, in correspondence to Z's where 1 plus Q naught have a non-trivial kernel, okay? Now, one analysis for which Z is, there can be, this thing might not have non-linear kernel, and it turns out that, if you have a point Z where this operator here has a non-trivial kernel, necessarily this point Z is an eigenvalue for H. And there is a one-to-one correspondence between elements of the kernel of 1 plus Q naught Z and elements of the kernel of H naught, of the corresponding kernel of the eigenspace of H. In particular, moreover, an elementary analysis of 1 plus Q naught allows you to conclude that 1 plus Q naught has only finitely many singularities, and correspondingly, that H has finitely many eigenvalues, and all with finite rank, finite dimension. Okay. In particular, there is one exception to what I said, and it is the case when lambda naught So when the this kernel is, you may have that this kernel is non-trivial, and correspondingly the kernel is trivial, of H is trivial, and this happens, that might happen possibly when what I call lambda naught there is 1, an extreme of the continuous, one of the two extremes of the continuous spectrum. This is the notion of resonance. So you might, so there is, this can be, can be non-trivial, while this is trivial in case H has a resonance at the two extremes. I mean, this happens for lambda equal to minus or plus 1 at most. So now let's forget, I don't want to discuss in this moment what happens at 1 or at minus 1, so let us say that nothing happens there is no trouble. Let me pick a lambda naught which is embedded in the continuous spectrum, say here, and notice that the spectrum for these operators is symmetric with respect to the coordinate axis. Okay. So what happens to lambda naught? The question is, so now this thing has a singularity, so how does the singularity look like? And maybe I want to quickly, it turns out that the singularities, so one other thing I have to say, Q naught, this function here, so if it has a singularity here, notice one plus Q naught is defined as a meromorphic function in the upper half plane, and then in around any point here of the continuous spectrum extends into a meromorphic function in part of the lower half plane. And one question is, what's the principal part of this meromorphic function? And it turns out that it, just to make the discussion quick, it turns out that it is such, this principal part is, it is such that this whole product will give you, as a principal part of this thing here in the left, exactly what you expect. The restriction, in other words, of this thing into the kernel of, what I want to say is that, at the end, the conclusion, which is non-trivial, is that the principal part of this is equal to A R H comma Z N G H minus lambda naught plus etc., which is non-trivial because this is trivial if I'm dealing with isolated eigenvalues. It's non-trivial when I take eigenvalues which are contained in the continuous spectrum. Okay, and so conclusion is, to make a very quick, long story quick, is that if you take something whose projection inside this space is trivial, and you apply to it this whole thing, you apply to it this will not explode, okay? Because because the principal part of this is this, so V applied to this is equal to zero, V applied to the principal part is equal to zero. So in other words, this thing, very quickly, this thing is bound. It's bound. This thing can be proved because, I'm trying to go a little quickly, just as a curiosity. For me, it was more of a curiosity than anything else. People did not, apparently, did not know. So a question, if you take something which is supported in, which lives in the continuous spectrum, W is a very useful operator, because it allows you, for example, to define functions of H and things like this. Now, if you take functions which are supported in the continuous spectrum, you might wonder what's the sign of their energy, and it turns out that if you call F the operator in the element in L2 which is sent by W into phi, the energy of phi in the definition given before is nothing but this. So this is positive, and so the energy is positive when restricted in the continuous space. For me, it's more of a curiosity. So now I want to study, I want to come to Green lattice now. So what happens to this thing? So what we are doing is this. I'm picking H. So H has this has spectrum which given in this of this type. I want to really focus on lambda naught. What is happening to lambda naught? And for simplicity, let me pick the kernel let me say that the dimension of H minus lambda naught be equal to 1. Okay? And let the generator of let F be a vector, which an eigenvector, which therefore spans this space. Okay, so kernel, I forgot to write the kernel. So let's say that this is one-dimensional generated by F, and then we will have the energy of F, which I remind you from what I said before, has the sign of this quantity sigma comma sigma 3F. So the energy can be either positive or negative. And I know that it is possible to be built negative energy eigenvalues. I don't know if positive energy eigenvalues exist. Okay, so there is a tool what I will do is I take H and then I perturb it, and you want to compare the position. I mean, you want to track what happens now. So the eigenvalues of H get move, and you want to follow them, and one way to follow them is by means of the so-called Weinstein-Aaron-Sturgeon determinant. Follow work of Holland of 71, I think. And the point is, let's see, there is a, maybe it's a little more complicated than necessary, there is a meromorphic function, delta, which can be defined starting from these two. Okay, so I take these two resolvents and I multiply on left and right. And now I remind you, so the previous analysis tells us that these are meromorphic functions and these are the principal parts. Okay, and essentially I want to track the pole of these functions. So I have Q, I'm perturbing the operator H, I get another function Q1. The pole of Q moves in some continuous way, and I want to find where's the position of the pole of Q1, and say that the new tildes are the positions of this. Well, the new tilde is a number, is like the dimension of I define these two numbers. Okay, this is the ranks of the eigenspaces here new tilde. This will be either 0 or 1, because I'm taking this to be one-dimensional. It's clear that to study the relation of these two, you somehow take a factorization of this involving the inverse of this operator here. Now, the Aaron-Sturgeon-Weinstein determinant is obtained in this way. There is some sort of quasi-inverse of this operator, which is analytic, vector-valued analytic function, which is a quasi-inverse, and so that this product is 1 plus a finite rank operator, which is meromorphic in Z, and then the determinant is defined by simply, F is now finite rank, the determinant is obtained by simply restricting this operator here. One is the identity operator, by simply restricting this operator to on the range of F, so it becomes... I'm sort of forgetting, in some sense, the continuous spectrum right now. But, you're right, I'm dividing that. Maybe it's this. So it's maybe a little more clear. I don't know if I interpret. But the point is, there is a relation like this. So this is an idea of Holland. I mean, he's even older. I mean, but the point is that he studied this in the context of self-adjoint operators for lambda naughts, which are embedded in the continuous spectrum. Okay. So let's see. So in other words, now the point is, the zeros of this function here, of this partial delta, give you the location of the eigenvalues of the operator H1. Okay, so let us take, therefore, rediscover the result of Green-Lattice now, what I have said. So let's take lambda naught. So in this case, we have this equality here. It turns out, let's do the expansion. So this is the principal part. This is a meromorphic function. So this is... The QC is a function which is meromorphic around lambda naught. I have an epsilon floating around, so I can certainly take this inverse. Now this plays the role of this script A, and F now is this thing here. So if I calculate one, the determinant of this quantity here, the zeros of the determinant will give us the location of the eigenvalue, of the unique eigenvalue will be unique, or what, of the unique singularity of Q1. So let us see in, so when you do the, you look at that formula, I mean, in other words, the determinant is nothing but this, when you write what P is, okay? So it's this expression here. Now, how do you calculate the determinant? You simply take this vector, A1 phi, and you plug it inside here. You take this number. So in that case, it's rank 1, so the determinant is simply the number. So you solve this equation here. Let's do a Neumann expansion, so we will obtain this expression here, okay? So we are looking for the solution Z of this equation. The important thing, now I want to look at the imaginary part of Z. And the imaginary part of Z is equal to this expression here. And now, using the wave operator, maybe we can forget about this. The point is the imaginary part of this is this, okay? Now the numerator using the wave operator, if you use the wave operator, you realize that the numerator is non-negative, so generically is positive. But here, this thing here can be either positive or negative because the sign of the quantity below, I should have used instead of, so C is F, okay, so C, I should have used C. So the sign of the denominator is exactly the energy. So when this energy is negative, these two minuses cancel and the imaginary part of Z is positive. So it means this thing jumps out here. If the energy is positive, it goes down and disappears. Okay, and that's Grillati's result. I have to say that the result, so this is a proof easy if one is familiar with the theory of analogous theory for nonlinear Schrödinger operator developed by Holland or Barry Simon in early 70s, okay? In particular, I mean, this sort of result is essential paper by Tsai and H.T. Yao mentioned this morning by Michael Weinstein when he was discussing about the existence of an unstable manifold in the around containing excited states. And they reproved the result. They tried to give an elementary proof. I mean, a more elementary proof than the one in the original paper of Grillakis. But I mean, they make a lot of effort. But I mean, what I want to emphasize here that is you can view this whole problem in classical terms, going back to, I mean, to material developed 30 years ago. Let me mention that the result that I have discussed, and as well as what I'm discussing now, later, is all joint work with Dmitry Perinovsky and Vitaly Volgotar. And this is going to be ready soon. What I discuss now is sort of a little bit work in progress. So now I will discuss a little bit what happens if one is an eigenvalue. Okay, so forget a lambda naught now. We look at one. So similar phenomena, similar phenomena when one is an eigenvalue. So we will again experience similar bifurcation results. So I will assume, so one is an eigenvalue, I will assume that the kernel of H minus one is one-dimensional. Notice also, by the way, the operator is not self-adjoint, so it might very well be that the algebraic and the geometric dimension do not coincide, but I will assume the kernel has geometric and algebraic dimension equal to 1. And I repeat, an important parameter in the problem will be the energy of C. If we maintain the analogy with that I discussed earlier, that these operators look like pairs of Schrödinger operators pointing in opposite directions, so now a positive energy, a negative energy eigenvector more or less seems to represent an eigenvector corresponding to the Schrödinger operator pointing in this direction, while a positive energy eigenvector seems to correspond to an eigenvector corresponding to this Schrödinger operator. And I mean, having in view a little bit this picture, this analogy with pairs of Schrödinger operators, one can try to track some of the arguments that I will discuss now. I mean, in particular, the issue of the sign of certain quantities. So we will consider psi, and if you consider a solution of this equation, you can in some sense forget about this. Let's be a little formal. So H is equal to H naught plus V. So if you pull V is an exponentially decreasing, is formed by exponentially decreasing entries. So if you write this equality here in terms of the components, it turns out that you get this expression. Now, if you know, and in the context we are working really, we care only about Cs, which in fact are almost in L2, I mean, are not increasing. If you look at this expression, now G and F are rapidly decreasing. This is therefore a rapidly decreasing function. This operator here acts like a convolution with an exponential decreasing function, and therefore C2 is rapidly decreasing. So this function here is always in L2, while here, this expression here, being a convolution with respect simply to 1 over x, decays generically like 1 over x. So, and this difference, so, is in L2. Now, for C to be in L2, so for the eigenspace here to be, for C being really the generator of this eigenspace, we need, evidently, this quantity to be equal to 0. So, and then what follows? I will assume that this integral is equal to 0. The integral of the left-hand side is equal to 0. So now we'll use in the context of what I'm discussing, what I will do will be the following. I will take the resolvent of H, and I will consider some sort of expansion of the resolvent for the argument here going to 1. Okay, so I will consider the resolvent of H, and I will study its behavior near 1. And I replace what I'm doing here, also I'm replacing z with 1 minus z square. So what this is doing is evidently, so if this is the z space, what this transformation is doing is to send this region here into the z space, in the zeta space, into the part of the plane where the real part is larger than 0. Okay, so the real part larger than zeta corresponds to this region here. Notice that the kernel of the resolvent of the unperturbed operator can be written very explicit, and it is, in some sense, an analytic function in zeta, on this new parameter zeta, and we have an expansion like this. I want to emphasize this term because we will discuss it briefly later. We can think of this as an expansion. I mean, if we think of this as the kernels of the operators G1, G2, G3, et cetera, et cetera, we have an expansion like this. And from this expansion, I mean, if we assume, as I am doing here, that the kernel of H at 1 has rank 1, and is non-trivial, it has rank 1, and if I call P naught the corresponding projection, there is a projection in this space, we have an expansion of the resolvent of H, which looks like this. And this is work of, basically, Jensen and Kato. Okay, so we will use this expansion. So what we do is we try... So now what we are doing, so what do we do? So this is all done for H, so now we take another operator H1, like before, equal to H plus epsilon V1, I mean the V1, and also what I will do will be to write V1 as V star 1 A1. So I will do a small perturbation of H, and I will track what happens to the eigen, to the eigenspace of H. I mean, what happens? We have what happens to the eigenspace of H1. So there is an exact similar discussion, and there was there is a. So I'm and what I will do will be really I will. So now I take so here instead of taking the resolvents, really I multiply left and right by these rapidly decreasing functions B1 and A1, and I rather than considering the resolvents, I'm considering these functions here, and I'm looking for their pole. So the eigenvalues maybe correspond to the pole. Okay, so where's the where are the poles of Q1? Well, you have a similar equation to the previous one. Okay, so the poles are obtained by solving this equation here. It's exactly the same discussion before. You remember we had the determinant, so there is exactly the same discussion. Okay, so we say if we do some sort of expansion, I mean working a little bit informally, we get an expression like this. One important thing that is this: if eigenvalues of Q1 will correspond to solutions of this equation with real part larger than zero, because in terms of z, it means that the real part larger than zero corresponds to zb, the corresponding zb in this set here. If real part is either imaginary or say negative, then what it say, for example, if the real part of z is negative, it means that somehow the corresponding z is not anymore here, but is in the other sheet of the Riemann Riemann surface associated to the resolvent, and look, it is exactly the way the disappearance of eigenvalues when they become resonances and they move to another sheet. I mean, singularities move to another sheet. We have this equality. So let's see. If this part here has the right sign, I get a solution zeta, which is with positive real part. Let's see. What does it mean? Because I mean, if this is negative, when it's pulled on the right-hand side, becomes positive, to the dominating term, take the positive square root, and I get something that has positive real, real part, a zeta which has positive real part, and a corresponding eigenvalue, which looks like this. What are the signs? I mean, these signs mean the following, then, that, I mean, they are consistent with the picture. I mean, in other words, you have to think in terms of Schrödinger operators. If you take a Schrödinger operator, you have an eigenvalue embedded here. If you add a small potential to this Schrödinger operator, which is negative, for example, a small negative potential, this will push the eigenvalue in this direction. So and the condition is on an inner product, really. In other words, if the denominator is positive, which means psi can be thought as an eigenvalue of this Schrödinger operator here, and if this inner product is negative here on top, so in other words, if you think, for example, V1 is negative, is a negative potential, so in order to get an eigenvalue, you have to add a negative potential. This will push in this direction. Okay. On the other hand, if psi has negative energy, if this energy here is negative, in other words, if you think of this eigenvalue as an eigenvalue of this Schrödinger operator pointing in this direction, and you forget about the other Schrödinger operator, then in order to have the eigenvalue move in this direction, you have to add a positive potential. So this accounts for the signs. This is the easy part of the discussion. I mean, symmetry arguments tell you that you have only one eigenvalue. It lies in this interval. And and to a first order approximation is positioned here in this point. So now let us consider what happens when the sign of this quantity is the opposite one. In other words, for example, if this is an eigenvalue corresponding to this Schrödinger operator, we add a positive potential and we try to push the eigenvalue in this direction. Okay, so what happens is the following. So if we work in this analogy, if this eigenvalue corresponds to this Schrödinger operator, what you will have when you try to push the eigenvalue in this direction is exactly what you get when you do the same operation for Schrödinger operators. So when you push the eigenvalue in this direction, what you have is that really the eigenvalue disappears. Okay, and that's what happens here. And on the other hand, if this eigenvalue corresponds to this operator here, okay, what will happen is that, and if you try to push it down by adding to this Schrödinger operator a negative potential, what will happen is that this thing here will split into eigenvalues. And also, I'll have here in what follows, if I have the time, a Fermi golden rule giving the position also. Okay, so now there will be, so let's have in mind this formula. I have this expression. This expression here is given by this easy formula, is always negative. I don't like to think of the fact that this is equal to zero as a non-generic, because if you take the F, G, and the Psi spherically symmetric, this thing is obviously equal to zero, so I don't like to think that this is a generic condition. But I mean, in some sense, it's not a generic condition. So let us consider the case when this is strictly negative. Then, what happens to the eigenvalue when you push it, when you throw it against the continuous spectrum by adding a potential with the right sign? So let us say that, for example, this eigenvalue here is the corresponding energy is negative. So we can think of this as an eigenvalue of this Schrödinger operator here. So in order to push this thing this way, we will have to add to this Schrödinger operator here a potential of negative sign. So in other words, we will add this thing here. Okay. So now approximately the equation that I wrote earlier is approximately a quadratic equation. Here I'm taking epsilon positive, xi is simply this, and theta is equal to this quantity, and because this and this now are both negative, it's strictly positive. So you solve the quadratic equation, and if more or less is correct, and so what you get is two solutions. Evidently theta is positive, so two solutions with positive real part, okay? And then if you write zeta z equal to 1 minus z square, zeta square, so in other words, the corresponding two values of z are given by this formula. So in particular, what this shows is that when you have a negative energy eigenvalue and you throw it this way, you see, you have what you will have is the fact that this real part, I repeat, the fact that the real part of zeta is always in both cases larger than zero means that the corresponding z plus and z minus leaving this set in this sheet of the Riemann surface, and they are eigenvalues. And in particular, I want to point out here you have this distance from the continuous spectrum, and the imaginary part is given by this formula here. Notice that if instead you think of this eigenvalue as an eigenvalue of positive energy, in other words, as an eigenvalue corresponding to the Schrödinger operator to the Schrödinger operator here, and therefore in order to throw the eigenvalue upward, I mean on the right, you add a positive potential. In other words, when you take this potential positive, here theta will be negative because this is always negative, so the product will be negative, and so this means that the real part of theta will be, of zeta will be negative. So this means, in other words, that the corresponding z's are in the other sheet, in other sheets of the Riemann surface. So you don't have eigenvalues; the eigenvalue disappears. So this is the generic case, And now let me, last slide, discuss the generic, this case here, what happens when this term is not there. And the discussion is, maybe I hope not confusing, we get a similar result, except in a different way. So the previously, we were tracking the singularities of this thing here, of this meromorphic function in zeta, and we had an expansion giving us the principal part of this meromorphic function. Now this term here will be equal to zero. Okay, so this term here is not anymore here, and when we write I repeat, as before, for the same reasons, the location of the poles of this function are obtained by looking at solutions of an equation of this type. Or here I'm throwing higher or smaller terms. Okay, and say that I will consider the case where this has negative energy. In other words, this is an eigenvalue which corresponds to the Schrödinger operator pointing in this direction. So I will consider the negative energy case. Let's see, what happens is, so I wrote this thing. So this is, I have done here Neumann expansion, first of all. These are the first two terms. So I have this expression here now. Okay, now I do the following. I split this as a sum of its real and imaginary part. By the way, Q of C now basically correspond to the restriction of H in the continuous spectrum. Okay, so now I have the real part of this, evidently is absorbed inside here, plus the imaginary part of this. And here I use the, how is it called, Pleinelli formula. So I will get an expression of this type. And I will get an expression of this type. Let's see. Now another thing. So this the sign. So the sign, the real part of Z. Let me go ahead. So I will rewrite this expression now. So what happens is that this expression here, this z square is basically up to epsilon square order terms is basically equal to epsilon times this inner product. So when I consider this expression here, so I replace now in this discussion real part of z square with 1 plus epsilon times the inner product, okay? And then by using this wave operator, which transforms basically my operator H into basically the Laplacian, really this thing here boils down to an expression of this type, where I forgot here to write, to draw this, the left-hand side of the inner product. So here I have an inner product of an expression like this. And an expression like this now is approximately equal to something like this. So here there is, so this quantity here is positive generically and small of the order of square root of epsilon. So in other words, so here I have this is a square root of epsilon basically. And now I have to think a moment because I forgot exactly to so it should come out. There are, say, approximately two solutions of this equation. There will be two solutions of this equation, and they will have the right real part, so it will be positive. So correspondingly, although I don't explain it here well, and I don't remember exactly the argument. And z, I remind you, z was equal to 1 minus zeta squared. So when we look at z, and we call x and y the components, approximately the components of z are these. Okay, so in other words, now in this case, you are multiplying the square root of epsilon with epsilon squared, so the distance of the two, there will be two eigenvalues as I throw this into against the continuous spectrum, and they will have distance of this order of magnitude. Okay, so there is a dichotomy when you I throw this eigenvalue in this direction, if up to mistakes in the whole discussion, and in one case if a certain quantity is different from zero, the distance we say is of the order of epsilon to the 3/2 in terms of the parameter. If this quantity here is equal to zero, the distance is smaller. Okay. And I think here, I finish here the discussion.